Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. Geico has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, how are you folks today? This is Andre Cohen calling live from AM Horizon Studio here in crisp Minnesota. Today's weather is very crisp. It's starting to cool off a little bit. Leaves are starting to turn. Most of the leaves on the trees here have not fallen yet, but I'm sure that will come in time. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the death of Muammar Gaddafi. We'll speak a little bit about how we came to be diversity trainers, and we'll start soliciting more questions and comments from you. We'll kind of do some frequently asked questions around diversity, and so let's get started with today's program. So first of all, I want to talk a little bit about how we have come to be diversity trainers, and where did that start and originate. A lot of people are curious about how to become a trainer and what it means to become a trainer, and if you go online to organizationallift.com, what you will find are a bunch of courses that are available, and there is a set on how to be a trainer. So I have a train-the-trainer set of courses online at organizationallift.com. And so in that, we encourage folks to engage in our learning processes. And so I'll just tell my story, and then I'll tell you how that relates to our courses on organizationallift.com. And so as many of you know, and I've written this in my bio, and actually it shows up in a number of my books, that that growing up, my father was my pastor, was a minister, and he went to Dayton United Theological Seminary, and became a ordained Methodist pastor, and served in the Methodist Church. Prior to that, he was as a young man, coming out of high school, saw the injustices in the world, wanted to do something about it, and joined the Black Panthers. And the Black Panthers were pretty radical in the sense that they knew 2 things. They knew they had constitutional rights, and secondly, they knew what those rights were. And so when you are an angry Black person and you know those 2 things, that makes you, it places a target on your life. And so my father was considered one of these Black radicals. And then at one point, he had a burning bush encounter where he had a conversation with God. And he and God came to some understanding. And one of the understandings was that his life was worth more than how he was living it and spending it. And so he answered the call to ministry and into personal salvation through Jesus Christ. And so moving from that really socially focused movement of helping to engage, change, and lift people out of poverty to looking at how we can lift people's souls from the trajectory of going to hell is how he moved his enthusiasm and life energy to make sure that those things happen. And so as a result of that, I grew up in a household that was very civically minded. As a young person, I was a card-carrying member of the NAACP and participated in a number of the youth engagement projects that the NAACP participated in. And at a certain point, though, in my life, in my teenage years, I started to see the limited perspective that the NAACP was offering. Now, what I will say is not that the NAACP is a limited organization, but from my point of view, the focus was a bit more narrow than what I thought my life calling would be. And so, leaving my junior year of high school, I stopped participating so much with the NAACP, and I really got involved with an organization called the American Youth Foundation. And I have to tell you, this wasn't necessarily a noble cause that how I got connected with this American Youth Foundation or this AYF. To be quite honest, all the cool kids that I knew were going to these camps in Michigan, and so I really wanted to be one of these cool kids. And so I saw the relationship between going to camp and being one of the cool kids. Again, not the most noble of positions. I'm a junior in high school, sophomore in high school. So a lot of my decisions were very much based on who I am and who I wanted to be and all of that. And so in that, as a part of that that program of being engaged with the American Youth Foundation, we did workshops at school. And again, my motives were not the purest motives. There were cute girls in these leadership groups, and I wanted to be associated and affiliated with these cute girls as well. And so I recall going to a number of sessions and learning this leadership stuff, and I thought it was cool, you know. I was able to get out of class. I was participating in all these things. But I actually started to see the power of individuals working together to get things done. And that really intrigued me. And so I spent a summer in Shelby, Michigan, at a place called Camp Minnewanka, where I met some very life-changing friends and had some very life-changing experiences. And so in that, I met some lifelong mentors that really did a great job of taking me in. Because one of the things that had happened in the process of kind of going through high school was my parents faced a pretty nasty divorce, and I was feeling a little bit lost. But I would not have identified myself as being lost. I would have said I'm being me, and I'm deciding who I'm going to be, not knowing that that was the path of a lost child trying to define himself in a particular kind of way. And so I encountered two individuals, actually three individuals, that really helped to shape my paradigm. One is a gentleman named Leon Sharp, and I do believe he has a consulting group called Praxis. And so if you just Google Leon Sharp and Praxis, you will you'll find his bio. And he was very instrumental in helping me to understand the systems of oppression and how folks get caught in it, what roles we play in it, and how we actually break that cycle. And so a lot of the ways that I think and the things that I've learned about diversity have come from his mentorship and his the tools that he uses in his work. The second individual that was extremely profound in my life was a woman by the name of Tess Tiernan. And Tess Tiernan was a principal in St. Paul, a very powerful, dynamic woman. And one of the things that she said to me that really stood out for me, because in street vernacular, Tess Tiernan would be someone who was down for the cause. She was this spunky white woman who was very clear on the issues of diversity, was an advocate for diversity in all levels, you know, not just, you know, race, but gender, religious bigotry, all of this stuff. And she was almost like my second mother. And Tess said something that was very profound to me that helped to change or turn a page for me. And in one of my conversations with her, I was telling her how cool it was to have a mentor like her, you know, a white woman that is queer. And I think I used the phraseology that she was the blackest white woman I had ever met or something like that. And she laughed, but then she turned to me with a stern tone, and she said, "Andre, I want you to remember one thing, and I don't want you to ever forget this, but I am a white woman." And I said, yes, I know that. No, she looked at me again and said, "Andre, I am a white woman." And I said, I'm looking kind of dazed and confused by her repeating this response. And so what she shared with me was, not to forget that there is a power dynamic in this society, and that just because she's clear on the issues does not mean that sometimes she does not succumb to some of the systemic or people expose her to some of the systemic racism that oftentimes happens, and that that people don't necessarily create for themselves, but fall into those traps. And so it was very important for me to kind of understand that about her. And to this day, I love her as my mother. And the last person was someone who really touched my heart and really stretched me in some very important ways. And her name is Kathy Vertiber. And Kathy stretched me in some ways because there were points in my life where I was stuck. And Kathy was able to encourage me to get unstuck. And so by showing me and giving me practical ways of looking at the world, Kathy was able to help me make decisions that got me up out of the muck and miry clay, if you will. Oh, and there's one more person that I need to talk about is a woman by the name of Carolyn Gould. And Carolyn was a professor over at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. And she was a very particularly powerful individual because she was very unassuming, very shy, but very powerful. And one of the things that she said that really kind of shocked my world a little bit was that that all white people were racist. And in the context in which she said this, there was a conference of about 700 individuals, most of whom were white. And so to make a declaration that she did really rock people's worlds, and so it was very interesting to see an African American woman make a statement like that in front of all of the so-called white folks. And so in her doing that, she helped to really change how I thought and saw the world, and to actually question what some of those things were. And so it was very interesting to me to have someone say that. Now, in retrospect, do I believe that all white people are racist? I would say that I believe that everyone succumbs to gravity, that most of us have because gravity is a system that is is kind of unquestionable. It's something that we participate in even without our desire to. I believe that concept of racism plays out in a very similar way, that we don't necessarily ask to be a part of a racist system, but we are a part of a racist system. We don't And I also don't believe that that's limited to just black people. I believe that that white people suffer from racism and also participate in it, as well as people of color suffer from it, but they also participate in it. And so being able to have those four individuals in my life to really shape how I think about the world at a very young age really prepped me for the kind of work that we're currently doing. And so, again, and I speak of these books often because I think they've been profound influences in my life. So I would encourage you, if you're interested in doing this work, that you find Derek Bell's work. You can either look at Gospel Choir. I would first start with Faces at the Bottom of the Well. Really great conversations on what it means to be black, what it means to be a black politician, how black politicians have to work with the world. So I would encourage you to look at that. I would also encourage Dismantling Racism by, I have it somewhere, by the author's last name is Brandt, and you can look that up. And it really does a good job of constructing and deconstructing racism in such a way that we can look at actually doing something about it. The other part of that is that Dismantling Racism talks about how to undo the hurts caused by racism and the system of racism, and it pairs it with spiritual truths and spiritual ideals. And so one of the things that oftentimes is missed in the conversation about diversity is the spiritual aspect to which we do our work. It is without the moral imperatives that the church oftentimes brings forward, that particularly in the United States, we would have not been able to advance the causes because in our human rational ways of thinking, we can organize or make excuses. We can create reasons for just about anything. And it was, I have to say, it was the church, the spiritualness that individuals brought to the table that actually questioned people's ability to enact the kinds of injustices that they were acting, to counteract those things. How do you make a moral argument about slavery or oppression of any kind of folks when you have a foundation in spirituality and a way of thinking that does not support that or counteracts that or asks us to rise above those systems of behavior. And so I think it's that political balance between, growing up as a Black Panther, as my father's son, and really being socially conscious and operating in those things, as well as the spiritual principles and guidance that is often overlooked when we have these conversations. And I would say, if you look at the work that Gandhi did, a large part of why he was able to be successful was because he had that spiritual component to his social activism. And so I would say that any diversity work that you do and you have not checked in with your with some kind of spiritual guidance, that you're not connected in with some kind of spiritual being, you will find that a lot of your work oftentimes cannot necessarily be rationalized in a way that everyone can agree with. But once we tap into some of that spiritual connectedness among all people, we start to find principles and we start to find ways of living that are undeniable. And so we have to remember to tap into that stuff. And so what I would, for those folks who ask, how do you you know, become a diversity trainer or what does it mean to be a diversity trainer, I would encourage you to make sure that you read up on the things that touch your heart and your spirit, and that you are a spiritual centered person, because the attacks and challenges that you will face, in the words of my father, you know, or in the words of the Bible, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And so the enemies are not the individuals, but it's the thought processes that a number of individuals have been subjected to. And so trying to undo those thought processes takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of patience, it takes a lot of understanding, and understanding that people sometimes have been victimized by thought processes. I was speaking with a group of teens just the other day about words and the power of words. And we talked about the fact that words are containers for thought. And so how to communicate is that the best, the clear thoughts across to one another. And when we're not able to do that, we have miscommunications, we have our feelings across. And so it's very important that we understand that people are doing the best they can with what they have, and that oftentimes what they have is not enough. And so if you are thinking of being a trainer, one of the things you have to recognize is that the racist and the bigoted people that you encounter are not that way because they were born that way, or primarily because they were born that way. They were taught to do that and taught to live that way because there is something of value that they gain from participating in that enterprise of the people of resources, and that they're doing the best they can. That we have to figure out how to allow them to discover new ways of being and connecting, so that they don't have to use those old ways of.
What's the difference between bacon,
bacon,
and
bacon?
It's in the prep, because flimsy microwave bacon can taste meh. That's why Wendy's oven bakes their bacon for crispy slices of applewood smoked bacon that taste. Place it on fresh, never frozen beef, and you've got a junior bacon cheeseburger. It's the star of Wendy's 4 for $4 meal. Yeah, for just $4, you get a JVC, 4 nuggets, fries, and a Coke. Not to mention that crispy bacon that makes the 4 for $4 so deliciously different. At participating Wendy's for a limited time, offer includes small fries and a drink. Not valid in Alaska and Hawaii. Fresh beef available in the contiguous U.S. and Canada.